no Monday morning tariffs on Mexico after President Trump clinched an 11th-hour immigration deal for tougher enforcement, tweeting, "There's now going to be great cooperation between Mexico and the U.S." Mr. Trump, widely criticized for threatening tariffs, blasted as false a New York Times report suggesting weeks of trade tension, in fact, had not accomplished that much. Under the deal, Mexico plans to deploy 6,000 troops across its southern border to stop migrants from Central America. A senior administration official acknowledged to NBC News Mexico already had pledged 5,400 troops. And Mexico agreed to allow thousands of migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to remain in or be returned to Mexico while their legal cases proceed, an arrangement first agreed to by the U.S. and Mexico back in December. What's new, an administration official says, is an expansion of Mexico's commitments.
He brought Mexico to the table again, and what they're talking about they're going to be doing, it's going to be a game changer.
That game changer quote was from Acting ICE Director Mark Morgan in a report from NBC News. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast, in which we poke the hive mind of Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Howdy, folks.
Good morning.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Good. So that clip did a very good job of kind of setting us up. Basically, the president in late May threatened to slap a hastily prepared 5% tariff on all goods from Mexico that would have gone into effect today and then been jacked up in 5% increments every month until October, where 25% tariffs would have faced Mexico if they failed to satisfy the president's demands on helping out with immigration enforcement. Then on Friday, as mentioned, after some fairly cosmetic changes, Trump announced a deal. The New York Times kind of rubbished it on Saturday. Trump then went on a Twitter rampage on Sunday, calling the Times the enemy of the people and so forth. And then today, again, said that he might just put those tariffs back into place if the Mexican legislature doesn't do something or other. It's kind of unclear. Meanwhile, in semi-related breaking news, as we record this on a Monday morning, quote from Twitter, Trump says the U.S. will impose tariffs on China immediately if its president, Xi Jinping, does not, drumroll please, go to the G20 summit. Insert heavy sighs here. Catherine, what lessons have we learned over the past 10 days during the great avocado wars of June 2019?
I think I can confidently say we have learned no lessons, and we are doomed to repeat exactly this a few more times during the remainder of the Trump administration. The lesson that Trump thinks he learned is that when you get tough in a odd imitation of Jack Bauer-style diplomacy, that you get results. He's a little bit right, which is why he learned that lesson. It is, I am sure, true that the reason that the deal was done this weekend is because of this fake Monday deadline. As I think everyone on this podcast knows all too well, even fake deadlines can be motivating. And and that people also tend to work up to a deadline, even when it is known to be artificial by all parties.
You'll notice who left the hardest.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, we have like Beto O'Rourke is out there saying, you know, probably this accelerated the timetable. So Trump is saying, look, it worked. On the flip side, I think the New York Times critique that all of these things had already been negotiated, basically, is accurate because trade deals don't actually get done in a weekend in a rush. That's not how trade deals work. At the same time, I am very, very, very worried about the immigration piece, and in particular, the piece where potential asylees wait on the Mexican side of the border. That sounds to me like a great way to produce a semi-permanent refugee camp in which no one quite has the correctly aligned incentives to process those people and find them a permanent place of dwelling. I am very worried about it. Again, that wasn't negotiated in this last weekend. That was previously negotiated, but having kind of looked at that closer this morning, I now have dystopian nightmares about it.
Peter, I saw a lot of headlines over the past several days along the lines of Congress is really seriously thinking that maybe this time or probably next time they might furrow their brows extra hard at Trump when he does stuff like that. That's a paraphrase of a headline. You live in Washington, Peter. Is there any indication of legislative spinal regeneration over this stuff?
They're so serious, Republicans in Congress, and in particular in the Senate, where opposition to Trump's trade policies is much more concentrated. They're so serious that during a closed-door lunch last week, something like six Republican senators said that they thought the tariffs were a bad idea. That's how serious they are.
Woo-wee.
In a closed-door lunch, they were like, you know what? We just really don't think that this is good at all.
And did they say it like, did they use like ventriloquism so that it wasn't 100% clear who was speaking at that moment?
I mean, in fact, the Washington Post report that this comes from does not make it clear who all of the people were because
of the ventriloquism.
How serious Republicans are about stopping Trump's tariffs, about restoring congressional authority over these things. So the hope is if you were hoping that Congress will step in here, you should stop hoping that. It will not happen.
I will point out that Mitch McConnell, in a press conference that got some attention last week, I think the phrase that he used was, we're not exactly big fans of tariffs over here. And this was portrayed as like, oh, wow, Senate's really pushing back. Like, you know what? Saying that you're not exactly fans, that's not what pushing back looks like. Nick, you're a nihilist. No, you're not a nihilist. But on those rare
sometimes, on some days.
On those days that you flirt with the nihilism deep in your soul, do you ever feel like saying, screw it, let's just let Trump have all of his big tariffs and all of his big whatever he wants to do with immigration? Let's let Steve Miller and Ann Coulter finally be satiated. Or do you think it's possible for that, the thing that's driving that kind of mentality, those sets of policy desires and personal desires or whatever, to ever truly be satiated?
I think that's an interesting question, and it gets to what might be a difference. I'm not sure about this between kind of people like Trump on the right and some people on the left, where Trump, it's all positional stuff. It's just, you know, in any given conversation, he just wants to win that conversation, I think, or like express dominance somehow. And so with stuff like trade, I think with immigration, with any policy discussions, and I remember reading profiles of him before, you know, when he was running for president, about how people would say he would negotiate down, like, you know, you would sign a deal and then right up to the point of execution, he would still continue negotiating just to get like a few more table crumbs, you know, into his pocket, you know, right up until the moment that the checks cleared and stuff like that. And I think that's who he is. So, no, I don't think you can't say there will never be a moment where he's happy. And I don't know that that's necessarily a terrible thing, but I do think it's a personality trait. I'm not sure about on the left. If you give Bernie Sanders Medicare for all, then will he be happy or will he continue to negotiate for the next thing and the next thing and the next thing? I'm not sure. It may not matter. The stuff with Trump right now on trade, and I think this is something for libertarians and free marketers more broadly to think about, is that there's enough noise in the economy where trade, you know, tariffs are not going to necessarily have immediate effects that really, you know, make the economy stop moving. They're a bad idea. And that's one of the reasons why we need to keep repeating arguments against them. But you can cover up a lot of that. And, you know, in the end, you know, trade with Mexico is a much bigger deal for Mexico with America than it is for America with Mexico. So we can screw around with a lot of that without it necessarily immediately, you know, screwing up, you know, anything more than maybe our avocado prices.
This is going to be a really good opening sentence, which I refuse to further explain. But I spent the weekend in Santa Fe with a guy that runs a pipe fitting company. And he showed, yep, I know. And he showed me, because we were talking about these tariffs, his email inbox, which contained dozens of emails just from the last week, conveying the information to both buyers and sellers in his network that the prices of various items were going up in response to tariffs. So it was just dozens and dozens of emails from an American businessman and entrepreneur literally passing along the cost of the tariffs to his consumers in real time. It was a really striking illustration of, you know, each increase was tiny, but, right. And he sort of joked You know, if I were an unscrupulous businessman, I would use this opportunity to raise my prices even over and above the cost of the tariffs, because right now there's such a flurry of cost increases in so many industries that, speaking of noise in the system, it would be easy to lose perspective.
No, and also the amount of uncertainty all of this injects, which I guess goes to Matt's point even more, that Trump is, you know, there isn't like a finish line for anything, so that whatever happens now, there's going to be another mini crisis and another mini scandal and another this and another that. And, you know, that all builds in ultimately to having a negative effect on the economy. But if the main action in the economy is going well, you know, you can put up with a lot of this stuff.
I would just note that the jobs report this month was pretty underwhelming, and
it's not seasonally adjusted. Yeah. So it's partly there's always a slowdown at this time.
But widely reported as a likely sign that the economy is slowing, and that is going to pose kind of some interesting problems for Trump in an election year if that happens. And that is exactly what you would expect to see from this sort of erratic trade sort of war, where Trump keeps threatening to impose tariffs on Mexico, and then lifting them, right? It's part of what you want with trade policy is not just low tariffs or no tariffs. What you want is a certainty that that the policy that is in place now will be the policy that is in place a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now. And I would just encourage everybody to read Eric Boehm's feature last week at Reason about Trump's trade war at one, which really kind of delves into this and looks at all of the uncertainty that Trump has caused, even if absolutely everything, including all the China stuff and all, the whole trade war was just sort of ended tomorrow. We would still have left in place a precarious economic situation in which suppliers and producers and people who need to move goods around the world, even American companies, some of which, for example, do some of their business just across the border in Canada and are constantly moving goods and across the border, when they can't reliably predict what the tariff situation is going to be, it makes it very difficult for them to do business, and it makes it much more expensive.
On the other hand,
if the economy tanks, if I can just say real quickly, if the economy tanks, Trump will double or triple or quadruple down on tariffs. So that it will be like a Smoot-Hawley kind of situation where things are screwed, and then he's going to do something that really alleviates, or takes away one possible way of restarting things.
And this quote, which he said on CNBC this weekend, I think gets to that point where he doesn't think of this as a question of what's going to happen with prices in America at all. That's not how he's framing the issue. He said on CNBC, "We got everything we wanted, and we're going to be a great partner to Mexico now because they respect us. They didn't even respect us. They couldn't believe how stupid we were with everything that's going on, where somebody comes in from Mexico and just walks into our country and we're powerless to do anything." So he's talking about immigration here, but the lead into this comment was him saying tariffs were the wedge that allowed us to force change on immigration and to force Mexico to respect us. And, I think you can sometimes overinterpret the kind of personality elements of this. But in this case, I think when someone tells you about themselves, you should believe them. And this is a good example.
And this
of that.
Is what Trump has been telling us about himself for years.
Peter, I want to address a little bit some of the arguments that I routinely hear thrown at us, including by people who self-identify at least partly as a libertarian or having some libertarian instincts, which are, look, Congress does nothing on immigration or trade for that matter. It just forfeits everything, hands it over to the executive branch. We can't house the world if the world wants to come all here at once. We've seen videos of people crossing over. It's a nightmare. There is no such thing as free trade with conniving commies there. They've been manipulating such, and it's about time that we had a president who thinks of Americans first instead of pleasing the bond markets and the bankers at Davos. What say you, Peter Superman?
Banksters.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I really think we have to worry about the banksters. No, the main thing I would say is that it's just a mistaken way of thinking about immigration, and Too many immigration critics, too many Americans think of immigration as fundamentally subtractive, as when people come here, it costs us something. And that the rest of us have to pay for immigrants when they come to the United States. And in some narrow cases, that's true. And, you know, it's becoming more true in California, which just voted to provide Medicaid benefits to a limited number of relatively young illegal immigrants. But for the most part, it's not. People add to the economy. People make the economy better for Americans. People make it possible for there to be more goods and services. They pay taxes. They consume fewer benefits. Immigrants consume fewer benefits overall than they end up using. And so it's really a kind of a zero-sum mentality about humans that just misunderstands how additional people interact with the economy.
Let's pivot here to a topic that I feel like all year long we've been talking about the same three things, right? We've been talking about trade and immigration like we just did, and Trump's kind of exertions and tweet storms and actions about it. And we've also been talking a lot about the kind of great platforming and deplatforming and social media wars. This is not just this year, it's previous years as well. A lot of news on that. Over the past several days, you had the unfunny conservative bro dude, Steve Crowder, having his heavily monetized platform investigated by YouTube because he was taunting a gay commentator, journalist of some sort. And I think he got ended up getting demonetized. The chain of events ends up with like history professors having their Hitler YouTube channels removed from YouTube. It was very confusing, especially for those of us who tried really hard not to pay attention to it. You had a New York...
So many Hitlers, so little time.
I know! A New York Times front pager from yesterday about YouTube radicalization that included a bunch of like pictures of such scary people as Milton Friedman on it. There's another big heave about how Google News has sucked the life force out of all local news, profiting $4.7 billion out of various people. And then in yet kind of another sign, and this is something that we've also been talking about increasingly, the great Sohrab Amari, David French wars, Tucker Carlson and the illiberal right are signing up on the Elizabeth Warren plan to break up big tech and somehow to regulate the social media platforms while the classical liberal wing of whatever exists of that, at least in the conservative movement, are basically saying, what are you even thinking about getting the government involved in like policing content on the internet? Do you think that's going to go well for you? Nick, I know you're cogitating about all this and you've been writing about it. We'll write more. Give us an overview maybe, or just like what out of that that rag bag of awful strikes you the most?
Hey, rags are useful, man.
So are plastic bags. Go on, Nick.
You know, to tie it into kind of the immigration and tariff story, there is an overwhelming sense, I think, in America right now. And I, you know, zeitgeists are tricky and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, that things are fundamentally beyond anybody's control. You know, like us in this conversation are good people, even well-connected people. So, you know, you mentioned like Steven Crowder, the guy he was attacking on his YouTube videos works for Vox, which is, you know, like a formerly potent new media site that, you know, had a virtually $1 billion valuation, which has been written down continuously and will continue to be this year. But it's like it's people who are powerful. Even they feel like they're powerless to stop something bad in the world. And I think what we're seeing with the tech platform and the social media platform is that Google and Facebook and Twitter and Apple and Amazon, Netflix, you know, they have too much power, even though it's not exactly clear what that means. Because like you look at that story that was in the New York Times, which is really paradigmatic of, you know, the fear, which is, and it was about a kid who started watching YouTube videos and then became an alt-righter until he watched a few more YouTube videos and then kind of became like an alt-leftist. So it's kind of a happy story that is about how, you know, you start out, you know, you go through a journey where you find out who you are by watching a bunch of stuff. Some of it is stupid. He never got that deep into the alt-right. But it's like, why is this even a story? It's, you know, and that's basically what social media and new media has been doing for us, is it gives us so much more stuff. And now we're kind of like crabby about it because, you know, we want it even cheaper. We're like Donald Trump in Mexico or something. Like, we want, what do we want, Google and Gmail to be even cheaper? We want YouTube to be even cheaper? Or, I don't know, because the stuff's already free, but we're unsatisfied with the offering. And then people say, well, oh, they have too much power. And like Facebook, you can't get away from Facebook. One quarter of this podcast deleted their Facebook accounts. You know, it's like actually kind of easy to walk away from it. The newspaper industry is in decline, and they're pissed that, you know, Google, through its search engine, manages to bring tens of thousands of people to their fucking stupid little stories that otherwise wouldn't know what it is. No, I
also
mean, it's like,
our,
you know,
stories.
What is your, yeah, no, I mean, that's what I'm looking at this stuff. And like, you know, this, I'm obviously the oldest person on the podcast, but like, I remember the 90s, and like as the web and as the, or the internet and the web got bigger, like Reason's reach became, you know, just, I was going to say geometrically, I almost said catastrophically larger, because we could reach more people, you know, and it changed the discussion. And that's not in spite of Google. That's like, they're the second iteration of all of these search engines that made it. But that's, you know, people are pissed. Like, they want to be able to exert control over stuff they don't like. And I think we're, you know, this is one thing, along with everything else that the internet has proliferated, is that sense of weird, like kind of learned helplessness. And what is particularly galling now, I think, is that we're at a point where business, various business factions, including sometimes the FANG companies themselves, the tech companies, and politicians are like, oh, we've got a solution to this, which is regulation. And there's like all sorts of stuff that's in the air that's going to, it's going to end with some kind of either de facto or de jure regulation, I think, of like tech. And it's not going to be good.
Shout out to my friend Howard Owens, who's the publisher of The Batavian in upstate New York, who pointed out on Twitter, he's been a local news guy for a really long time, reacting to that story, is saying, okay, you know, you have it in your ability, all of you local newspapers and websites, to not participate in Google News. Who's going to go first? And the answer, of course, is nobody is going to go first.
And just what, you know, follow up, not just like local, like small newspapers, but like a paper like the one that you worked at, Matt, the LA Times, which had 120% market share, you know, in its home base, you know, they're crying the blues. And it's kind of like, well, you know, reinvent yourself, learn to code or do something to, you know, to figure out how to keep your business going. But the idea that you're going to screw with the internet because your piece of the pie is not even necessarily shrinking, but it's not as big as you want it to be. You know, why exactly that means that then, you know, Reason is going to somehow get screwed by this, because we know whatever rules and regulations are put in place are not going to be for relatively small news sites that are a little bit off kilter.
Peter, you mix your sense of learned helplessness at the face of social media along with editing a whole bunch of pieces about media and social media and internet related panics there. I feel like when I'm reading, especially that the YouTube radicalization story, since the dawn of the internet, there used to be all these, like, you put E in front of it, and there, for a while there, like, you could, you know, etarget.com would suddenly, you know, increase the valuation of Target by multiples. And then the flip side happens where it's like, oh my God, people are doing the exact same thing that they've always done in every other media, only this time it's with new media. Run for your lives. How do you square your own kind of pessimism with your own observation of these kind of panics?
I'm investing in emattwelch.net.
Yeah.
Which is going to be huge.
.info.
Guys, it's where you're going to get all of your information. You know, my pessimism about social media is twofold. One is that I think users and the companies themselves, sort of the private part of it, people are just not great on social media. It's not really a good way to communicate with other people. And I don't think that the incentives are really there for social media companies to try to make communication with other people via social media particularly good. The incentives are there for it to make communication, to make you have a lot of it, right? And to sort of to make you spend time. I mean, Netflix, I think that one of the Netflix execs, and so it's not a social media company, but it's the same idea, right? That, and one of the Netflix execs once said, you know, we think of our competition as sleep, right? And that's true. And lots of people fall asleep watching Netflix, but also lots of people fall asleep. You know, the amount of time that we are spending with these products is really incredible. And so, you know, as I've said before, that is one of the reasons why I deleted Facebook. I found it just not very valuable. At the same time, it's really easy to log off. It's really, really easy to log off, to delete your account, to just not engage with it. Very, very few people have jobs or lives that truly require them to be on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. Certainly Instagram and Facebook, very few people have jobs or lives that require that. And I think that that is what is missing from a huge amount of the kind of the conversation about these platforms. Because the idea seems to be now that you can't log off, that like these things that these companies have so insinuated themselves into the lives of nearly every American that now we have to have them. But because we have to have them,
dopamine hit. Right, you need the dopamine hit.
That because we have to have them, they then have to be regulated. They have to become essentially public utilities, and it's a very bad way of thinking about the problem.
Catherine, I'm thinking here about the Tucker Carlson rant of last week, which still reverberates, where he, you know, basically said, imagine if there was someone who's actually a nationalist who also wanted all of her big regulations on business and big tech and trade. Of course, that person would win in a landslide in a presidential election, sort of foreshadowing his own eventual endorsement of Elizabeth Warren. But like to Nick's point on the of a common thread here, can we postulate a common thread of people on left and right, what they have in common when they want to go after tech? Is it like a shared sense of learned helplessness? The world is spinning out of control, and this is the way to do it. And what to what extent do you find it significant that Carlson, by name, like at the beginning of his rant, said, you know, the big problem is libertarians. They have too much power in Washington. They kind of control things. Isn't it interesting how they go after this little tribe of people who have like almost no political representation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've talked before on this podcast about how there's this sort of, you know, sob giggle that libertarians feel when they hear, the libertarians, they've run things for too long. It's like, oh, sorry. But the idea that that libertarians are kind of coming in for the criticism here is precisely because of this strange left-right alliance, right? If Tucker Carlson looks at his side and sees Elizabeth Warren there, and then you look over to see what the other side would be, it's us. We are on the other side of that alliance for sure. I was really struck by the open letter to YouTube's CEO from Vox.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, it's such an interesting artifact in the kind of the effort to claim sort of powerlessness and victimhood by a very powerful entity. I mean, this is, you know, the letter says YouTube is enabling its commenters and also other video makers to go after our guy, Carlos Maza. And there's this call for YouTube to restrict other people's speech because it's making their guy feel sad and bad. I mean, truly, that is the claim. And I mean, they say harassment. They say, you know, there's sort of these terms that are becoming more and more popular that bridge the I feel sad and I feel scared and I am actually endangered spectrum, which are three different things. But, you know, then you click on a video on Vox and they're all hosted by YouTube. And there's a little thing at the bottom that says, do you like this video? Subscribe on YouTube. And, you know, again, to your point, if they want to send a message, if Vox wants to send a message to YouTube's CEO, there is this incredible way to do it. They could stop using YouTube, and they absolutely won't. And that's a choice because they think the trade-off is worth it. You know, my kids don't fall into the terrifying pedophilia YouTube, you know, brainwashing Momo algorithm because I just don't let them hang out on YouTube unsupervised. And, you know,
wow.
I don't mean to sound like a
lino
annoying social conservative, but it's so easy. It's so easy. And I don't, you know, I get that people are just using it as leverage. They are saying, I don't want to opt out because I will lose out and I would rather force the people who disagree with me out. But
I feel like we are may well be entering the kind of last stage of capitalism that Schumpeter talked about in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, where everybody just wants the upside of capitalism or of market forces, you know, and the gales. You want the creative part, but the destruction part, it's getting to be a hassle. And you know, people lash out. He talks about this towards the end of that book about where people, you know, refuse to deal with kind of the back and forth and the fact that everything is trade-offs, you know, under any system, but especially under capitalism. And you can create a world in which, you know, because you don't like something, you pass laws or you know, throw as many blankets over it as you can, and you might not get rid of it fully, but you hamper it and you shut it down and you kind of make it worse and worse. And that's one way to slowly, you know, destroy an economy or a social system that otherwise is working extremely well. Because, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot lately of like, I dislike, you know, I don't particularly care for Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, but it's like, God, there's so much good stuff out there because of all of that and because of the larger system that produced it. And all we're doing now is looking, or the conversation is being led by people who have a very particular axe to grind, and that's all they want to talk about.
Also, though, Schumpeter wrote that at the end of World War II.
In the middle of World War II, right. When it looked like we were losing. Yeah,
but this idea that the end of capitalism has been upon us since the beginning of process, you know, the greatest accelerated period of growth in trade in human history ever. I mean, I think it's always worth, you know, the guys that buy gold and bury it in a tin can, like at some point they're right. Because at some point gold does go up, but there's opportunity cost.
Well,
like, don't prepare for the end of capitalism starting in 1950.
Here's a question for Peter, maybe in particular, because some of what he was talking about immigration and trade and stuff like that, where, you know, he's totally right, I think. How do you talk to the people who feel, and they may not have actually been done in by immigration or offshoring of jobs, exporting of jobs to China or to other parts of the world, but they feel that way. And that this is part of the question, I think, for libertarians to answer is, what is the script? What is the narrative? What is the story that we have that doesn't merely state economic theory that I think is completely accurate, but also gives them a way of understanding that, you know, the Mexican who's coming over here and is cleaning pools in Los Angeles for, you know, under the table is not the reason why auto manufacturers don't hire as many people in Indiana or Ohio. And what more important, not just like, okay, well, you lost these jobs because of these large forces, but then what comes next? What is there to look forward to in this? And I think we struggle a little bit with that.
I think it's hard. I think that's right. There's no easy answer. But what I would say is that if you look at geographically and just sort of and demographically, the populations that are most opposed to immigration tend to be in places where there are relatively small, relatively few immigrant populations and relatively few immigrants. And if you go to thriving, economically successful, often not very well governed, coastal blue cities, you find a lot of immigrants and a lot of tolerance for them. And that to me is pretty telling, is that the best way to get people to basically see immigrants as good, as productive, as equals, is to have them live around them and live in prosperity. And that is a hard thing. That's not something that you can just sort of do for people in a small town in the middle of the country. You can't just sort of transplant them.
Though also, luckily for our case, more and more people are doing that on their own.
But that is the trend line for people, is to move to those sorts of cities, where the jobs are. Certainly for young college grads, People are moving to where the jobs are, and those and jobs tend to be increasingly concentrated in relatively urban, relatively dense places. At least many of which are frustratingly pretty poorly governed liberal cities.
So this
do you
actually...
know what else proliferates there, Peter? Tents and cardboard boxes of the homeless. Go ahead.
People are pooping on the ground. I mean, this is, you know, Matt Continetti at the Free Beacon did a very good taxonomy of modern conservatism. And he describes this sort of strange alliance between the Tucker Carlsons and the Elizabeth Warrens as the post-liberals. And I think, you know, I actually for many, many years have been a skeptic of this thing that libertarians like to say, which is like, we need to reclaim the word liberal. You know, that was our word. We're classical liberals. We're the real liberals. We believe in. And it's like, stop. We lost that word. Like Peter just used it casually to mean San Francisco. Like, it's not ours anymore. But I am now officially reconsidering that view because it is the way to describe the thing that that coalition is against. They are against a rights-based rule of law that gives maximum space for individual autonomy. They are against the things that America has been experimenting with since its founding. You know, the idea of liberalism is what that coalition is against, and it's what we're for. And I think even talking about it is confusing because literally everyone uses that word in a different way and uses it to mean radically different things. But
people are rather liberal with the usage.
Yes.
I think that's
pedantic. Another meaning in which it's like, you know, to be generous and open-handed and accepting with other peoples. So, I mean, I don't know quite exactly where to take it, except for to say that that is the right way to think about it.
I think there's a useful relationship to point out here, just in terms of the way we were talking about the calls to regulate YouTube or for YouTube to self-regulate. And one of the kind of issues with that is that there is just a practical problem with an organization like YouTube that is a platform for speech, figuring out, setting up hard and fast and clear rules that everybody can understand and abide by. And so this is one of the, like, I would be willing to bet that anyone who has kind of decision power over who is going to get demonetized, who is going to be allowed on the platform, what the rules are, thinks at YouTube, thinks Steven Crowder is a jackass. I would be willing to bet that it is at least 99%, if not 100% of those people, they don't like him. And yet, they're probably also thinking, you know what we need? If we're going to do something, we can't just have a no Steven Crowder policy. That's not a policy that we can have in place. What we need is something that is clear and consistent and can be enforced over time. But what is that rule? What would that even look like? It's almost impossible to imagine a clear rule that would work there. And in the very same way, it's difficult to imagine what a government would look like that did what Sohrab Ahmari wants when he talks about a government that is in favor of the highest good and the best good, or the common good and even the highest good. And I think he had highest capitalized in his
maybe good
initial,
too. I think
right?
there were a lot of like vaguely Germanic.
And
capitalization.
The point is, there is no clear way to define what the public square should look like that is consistent, enforceable, that is clear, that is transparent, that everyone would feel is relatively fair. And so even beyond sort of like the philosophical issues that we have with all of these things that are real and significant, there's just this like basic practical problem of setting up rules and setting up goals and setting up systems that anybody can agree on. And what Tucker Carlson and Elizabeth Warren and Sohrab Ahmari and the please regulate yourself YouTubers all seem to want is something that they can't really quite define, except something that doesn't bother me ever.
And that conversation has to be had on both of these levels, right? Like, your critique is right. This would be hard to do. But that, I don't, like, totally effectively making that critique just gets us a Donald Trump-like situation where we say, like, okay, it's impossible to do this thing. And the next morning, Vox and Tucker Carlson and Elizabeth Warren all wake up together. Dear God, that's a threesome. And they say, we're going to refight.
Devil's triangle.
We're going to refight. We're going to refight this same battle, and because we're going to think of a new way to try to do it. We're going to use antitrust law. Right. We're going to use hate speech. We're going to use Section 230 amendments. We're going to, and I think that's why the place that I keep coming back to is, and this is, this is not always my approach to politics. This is often not my approach to political discussion, but to come back to the place of like, it doesn't matter whether it's hard or whether it's easy. It's wrong. It's wrong to do this. It will yield bad outcomes, but it is also, on a fundamental level, incompatible with the liberal values of society that you live in and benefit from every day.
I mean, it's will to power, isn't it, Nick? I mean, they're admitting it. Like, if I have enough power, I get to use the club. Give me the power so I can use the club.
That, by the way, is the subtlest Nazi implication right there. Like, when you have to do, like, the skip hop between, like, Nietzsche to Hitler, like, that's... It's will to power is a good way to accuse your opponents of being
Nazis.
It's a meaningful
critique of liberalism, that liberalism masks its will to power in the language of rule of law and disinterested regulations that just happen to perpetuate this or that thing. I think that critique is wrong. But yeah, Matt, I think that's right. And that's also one of the things that I think in a broader kind of discussion, when Catherine is talking not just about pragmatics, but also about ideals and principles, some of the time I think libertarian discourse about government and stuff, like, we assume the worst, we presume the worst of the people who are in power and want to be in power, etc. And in a way, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it almost becomes impossible to hold people to actual standards, even the ones that they articulate themselves. And like, maybe we should be doing that. And, one of the things I know that I have disagreements with, I think all of you, or at least some of you, about, I think that YouTube has every right to regulate and moderate its user content however it wants, but it should be absolutely full-throated in favor of, they should be making a liberal argument about why free speech is good and why they are providing this space. And if you don't like it, go fuck yourself, go somewhere else, because we're going to let all people do all things here, absent true threats and whatnot. I think, we need that. And we need to be, this is one of the things that we are so kind of beaten down in terms of like everyday life and people complaining about stuff and saying, like, in the midst of like unbelievable wealth and plenitude and good things, we're focusing almost exclusively on negative outcomes that need to be controlled by the state or some weird mixture of, Elizabeth Warren and Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson and the private sector, et cetera. We need a different rhetoric.
There is a nostalgic decadence to our politics right now that is, I think, pretty problematic.
You want to explain that? 30 seconds?
I like that phrase.
Yeah, I mean, look, what is politics about right now? It is about looking back to our glory days and then griping about how things are unpleasant today. And it's a bad way of looking at the trajectory of American history. The period, yes, there are troubles. Yes, there are things that could and should be better. But the entirety of American politics right now is focused on sort of saying, well, you know what? It was great. Like, America was great once. Literally, our president was elected.
It's on a hat.
On the basis of a hat that says "Make America Great Again." The idea that it was once great and we have lost that greatness, that is core to the Elizabeth Warren vision of American politics, the Bernie Sanders vision as well, and it's just, it's kind of decadent, right? And you combine that especially with the sense that our massive and unaffordable entitlement state is also, woefully lacking and not providing nearly enough to enough people, and that somehow or another we should be cutting taxes while expanding all of that, right? It's a real sense of kind of grumpy entitlement on the part of America's political class that I don't think is reflective of the actual situation of the economy and of social life in America.
Catherine, I'm going to invite you to agree with me here, in which I think one of our year-end episodes or year-beginning episodes, I postulated that the worst thing that happened last year is that nothing bad happened. By which I meant, like, we're all this unhappy at a time of economic growth and not a lot of big, ugly new wars. And so that's a precursor of the question. Can you, just racking your brains, can you think of a time when the basic you know, unemployment picture, the growth picture was so positive, not just in this country, but worldwide. And yet people felt that people's attitudes about where we are right now are so sour. It feels like there's been some kind of dislocation that has happened here.
I mean, of those of us on this podcast, only Nick can remember the 90s. So I guess I'll let him speak to that. But
May have been in Central Europe.
I have this vague vision of very large pants.
Sure. There was a wallet chain on those pants, I think. So, I mean, I think that people generally are ungrateful wretches. And I would actually expand that thesis even more broadly. I would bring in a little bit of Deidre McCloskey and Steven Pinker here and say, we are the children and grandchildren of the Great Enrichment, which has been going on for 200 years, and the Long Peace, which has been going on for 70. And everything is getting better every day. And people are very unhappy. And you are right that many of the kind of short-term indicators are even especially good right now, as you say, the economic numbers and things like that. I recently, at the behest of my my daughter's first grade teacher, listened to a really terrifying conspiracy theory podcast, which I may have mentioned on here before, called It Could Happen Here. And the premise of this podcast, which ultimately I do not find the thesis of this thing convincing, but the premise of it is, imagine one thing breaks. You know, imagine one of those numbers goes really south. Imagine we really get involved in a war. Imagine even just 1970s style rioting in American cities, which is not that far in our memories. How does that cause a cascade of failure in the rest of the system? And again, I am and will always be a theorist of the muddling through. I think people muddle through. That is what they do. Catastrophe doesn't come. Nirvana doesn't come. People just kind of get on with it. And I believe that that's what will happen. But the stories told in this podcast, I think, do make me worry about how relatively miraculously great things are right now and how badly people misapprehend their own condition.
I'm curious. I was just going to say, possibly to kind of pull on a Schumpeterian thread, if in fact, and Ayn Rand has said this and other people, that when one of the values or virtues of capitalism is that, as a broadly understood social, political, economic system, it gives people more opportunities to create their own meanings to their lives. That's what it does. It allows you to express who you are and what you believe in and what you want out of the world more fully than other systems. It might be that, existential angst is a luxury good, and we are, we're swimming in it because we actually have more time to think about this stuff. We have more ways to communicate. We have more ways to engage one another, and we have more ways to make meaning in our lives. And, to blend this with a Frankfurt School kind of commentary from Eric Fromm.
Cultural Marxism.
In the 50s and 60s. Yeah, no, but that there's an escape from freedom, that people don't want that responsibility, and they project outward onto other things, either things like, oh, well, climate change is coming, so we have to focus on that, and we have to straitjacket every aspect of our lives and our thinking process to forestall this, this kind of rapture-like end of world scenario that may or may not happen into the future. So we all focus on that, so we don't have to actually take responsibility for what we're doing day to day to create meaning in our lives. I think, that might be part of what's going on here, is that, we need to, kind of grapple with the idea that we have so much more freedom and so much more autonomy that we also have much more responsibility to not to tell other people how to live, but to actually come up with the way that we want to live. And that is hard. And it changes. I mean, decade by decade, what you think that is, it moves in and out of focus, I think, quite naturally. But as a society, we might be stuck in a place where we just don't want to do that.
This, by the way, is why even though nobody has a good word to say about the algorithms that increasingly control the things that we see and consume, that's why those exist. Those are all tools to deal with a world of maximal choice. And for the most part, they help people deal with it very effectively, and they're going to get better and better. So I think that's also just another small piece of this, is this idea of the algorithms have taken control from me, but also inexplicably, I would rather if Donald Trump had that control, is a piece that I've never, I struggle to understand it on an intuitive level, which is one reason that I sit on the other side of that divide from Elizabeth Warren and Tucker Carlson and always will.
And YouTube is what? It was founded in 2006 or it went online in 2006. It's such a new platform and a new technology. You know, we're still learning it and it's still learning us in a lot of ways. And it's like, it kills me that people are like, okay, we have reached the maximum development of all of this new stuff we're talking about regulating. And so we have to lock it down into whatever form it is now. Whereas it's, you know, we're going through a phase with it and we're learning how to use it. And we're, you know, it will come out on the other end. If it's worth keeping, we'll keep it and kind of learn how to live with it and exploit it for our purposes rather than the opposite.
Yeah. And it's really weird to me that everybody is blaming YouTube for their crisis of meaning. People had crises of meaning before YouTube. Like they did. We had the idea of a midlife crisis was a thing that was in wide cultural circulation.
It's the reality that at least half this podcast is.
It's an evolutionary certainty.
And in fact, it's evolutionary certainty. There's good social science research that people sort of get sad in their 40s, right? I mean, our Reason contributor, Jonathan Rauch, literally wrote a book about that. It's a real thing. And like it happened before YouTube, I do think, you know, sort of one of my issues with social media is the way, though, that it causes that. It causes people's existential crises to then exist, and like to, it makes them much louder.
It makes them public. Potentially contagious,
right?
As well.
Yes, it makes them louder. Yeah. It makes them contagious. It makes them public, and it makes people because you are exposed to everybody else's existential crises all the time. It makes it feel like
I sure am
everyone. Right, like there was an existential crisis of deepening and enlarging proportions that is going on. It's getting deeper, and it's like a swimming pool that somebody's digging out while also making another one next to it.
Thank you, Matt Welsh. Yeah, I mean, so this is the other thing that I, you know, I do think this is why the narratives of decline, both from the kind of extreme socialist left and from the first things right, like, the one piece of credit I will give them is that they are both consistent in that, like, they acknowledge the critique that we are offering here, that, like, before YouTube, you know, the novel was making people's existential crises worse, or, you know, all of these dances the young people are going to were undermining the morals or whatever. There's always
pinball
something.
Pinball machines.
Pinball machines, literally pinball machines, you know, comic books. Like, there's always something that people have looked to explain why they feel bad right now. And it's often culture, or it's often, you know, something in the kind of commercial sphere. At least the conservatives say, like, yeah, this is a long narrative of decline starting at the novel. And to some extent, while I think the progressive left doesn't say this, the real deep hardcore socialist types, the DSA types, do. They say, you know, there was a time when labor had power and everything was better, including culture. And so I at least, unlike the kind of scrappy, pragmatic regulators of other eras, these guys are telling a long story. It's just, it's a factually inaccurate story. Like, people have, it's very hard for me to look at every trend line out there, all the trend lines in Ron Bailey's new book, and say
this story matches up. New and because of YouTube.
Sadness is new and because of YouTube. Just can't be the way to explain those trend lines.
So, speaking of novels ruining everything, Suderman, or Catherine, or both, through the same person, suggested that we spend extra time talking about Neal Stephenson in our what the hell are you reading or consuming segment. So either one of you start. Why do we need to be talking about Neal Stephenson and ruining life and creating Bitcoin? Go.
We actually really should have practiced, Peter, like something we could have said in unison right now. Like, that would have been amazing if we had like spoken with one.
Yeah, I'm thinking of you guys are like the twins from The Shining.
Yeah,
right
we
now.
Really are. It's
Come
not.
Play
it's
with
not
us,
at all,
Danny.
Yeah, Peter, you go ahead because you have written about this book, and we are going to be minimally spoilery, okay?
Minimally spoilery.
We want people to read it.
It's also somewhat impossible to spoil this book because
it doesn't make any sense.
Such a sprawling, crazy, insane story. The new Neal Stephenson novels. Neal Stephenson is the author of, among other things, Snow Crash, The Diamond Age, Cryptonomicon, Anathem, Seven Eves. He is a writer who has, to my knowledge, never admitted to being a libertarian, but deals heavily with libertarian ideas and themes. In particular, Snow Crash was set after the decline of governments in a kind of in a hilarious
polycentric
satirical
legal order.
Right. Sort of a corporate, anarcho-corporatist world. And so he's been dealing with a lot of things, with a lot of ideas that that are of interest to libertarians for a long time. He's really interested in money, in gold, and sort of how currencies work in post-government currencies. Cryptonomicon is largely about the origins of cryptography and the attempt to set up an international non-governmental digital currency. Where have I heard about that before? This book was written in 1999, almost a decade before Bitcoin was in circulation. But his new book is, among other things, a weirdly optimistic look at the near future in which, on the one hand, social media has kind of overrun everything and become kind of awful. And on the other hand, people have figured out how to deal with that. And
muddling
it's kind
through.
Of, right. It's kind of great. So like in the middle of the country, where people are relatively poorer and there's a lot of like weird religious cults who also love guns. In the middle of the country, people believe a lot of not true stuff in the world of Fall. And they have, they're sort of overrun with kind of with garbage information. But for those who deal with information, for those who have access to resources, he posits that basically people will have either people will have in editors who work for them, who curate their streams, who sort of who figure out how to determine what in the world of news and social media is valuable. And
this is something that Neal Stephenson has been trying to figure out for a long time. Mm-hmm. In Diamond Age, he more or less predicts the iPad and also the idea of a newsfeed, the idea that different people will consume different subsets
of
what's
out there. But what he also says in the Diamond Age, he says that the sort of the elite files, these are these social organizations that pop up again in a post-government world. The elite groups, the more elite you are, the more likely you are to read the same newspaper as the other people who are elite like you, is that customization and personalization is actually something he suggests is for the plebs, for the word in the Diamond Age is thetes. And so Neal Stephenson is just a really interesting guy because for a bunch of reasons. And I would say that the biggest one, the most relevant one for our purposes, is that he is an incredible optimist and that all of his books sort of are about ways of humans solving problems, usually in a distributed manner, without need for government. And when government steps in, it is usually an irritation and often and occasionally a kind of catastrophic. And so he's really a fascinating guy. He's also just so much fun to read. Catherine, you are like a huge Neal Stephenson fan. Like in some ways, I feel like my love of Neal Stephenson, like I liked him, and then I caught your bug for him a few years ago, I think, is what happened here.
Also a contagion. Yeah, I mean, I would just say that to kind of wrap up our like absolutely insane fandom here, that when Peter and I both were reading advanced copies of this book, one thing we agreed is that almost every major beat at Reason is captured in this book. And in fact, as we were reading the book, we said, "If there's
e-cigarettes,
they're not e-cigarettes exactly, but I wouldn't describe that as a whole beat. I think the idea of using technology and substances to alter your conception of yourself and ultimately your own reality is definitely in there.
There's a whole like completely superfluous passage in which the main character just sort of walks through Seattle and observes fitness culture.
Yeah." There's a lot of that. There's like, a lot of digression.
Here's me walking through Seattle talking about like CrossFit. And,
how long is this book, Peter?
This one's
1,200 words or 1,200 pages?
Shy of 900. It's like 880.
Okay.
And that makes it a little bit shorter than some of Stevenson's other works.
Yeah, I have to say, I agree with you guys. Like, I was a big consumer of his work, and the Baroque cycle wore me out mostly because of the length. I think he did learn that lesson,
to be honest. Like, all the subsequent books, though still Stephensonian in their kind of bizarre scope and kind of multi-part structure, none of them have reached the excesses of the Baroque cycle. And in fact, almost all of them behave more or less in the reading experience like a conventional novel, even though they have multiple stories embedded in. Like, for instance, to be clear, there's a big chunk in the middle of Fall that just retells Genesis. Just in the middle.
So, among other things, the book is about, it's about this social media wasteland, but it's also about a guy who dies and then has in his will that his brain has to be uploaded to a server. And so it's about radical life extension through digital means. So he becomes the first brain that gets uploaded, and then other people get put into his
And then without giving
universe.
Away too much, we'll just say, like, once his brain is uploaded, it's like, first there was nothing, and then there was a mind, and then there was light, and then there was the word. I mean, he really starts at the beginning. So,
and then there is conflict.
And then there's conflict, and there are avenging angels and all kinds of other good stuff too. So I guess what we're saying here is, if you like reason, and especially if you like Ron Bailey, but also if you like this podcast, and if you are grumpy yet hopeful, this is the book for you. Also, his past books have basically predicted the future. So if you want to get in on the ground floor, read this one.
Nick, Neal Stephenson, Neal Cassady, or Curly Neal? Who do you?
Oh, boy. I'm going to have to go with Curly Neal, obviously. Yeah.
Do not know who those other two people are.
And, do you not know who Neal Cassady is?
No.
What?
Oh, golly.
I don't even know the category. Is it a music person or a sports person?
Neither, really.
Of two of the 20 most important books written in the 20th century.
The kind of transitional life form from the Beats to the hippie counterculture.
Yeah.
Neal Cassady, the driver, the ultimate driver in American.
The New Yorker says he is American muse, comma, holy fool.
Yeah. and Matt, just to tell you what I've been consuming, which is kind of a 19th century cognate in some ways to what Catherine and Peter were just talking about, but I'm reading Thackeray's Vanity Fair, which is this great classic sweeping novel of mid-19th century British manners. And it points forward to a lot of things, that ultimately became kind of understandable in a kind of market-based society with all of its excesses and stupidities, as well as the long reach of aristocratic etiquette and manners that was all kind of batshit crazy as well.
I will to keep the Neal's discussion short and clipped, that my favorite Neal, obviously, is Greasy Neal, the turn-of-the-century football and baseball player. Played in the
Neil Young?
1919 Cincinnati Reds. Nah. Neal Young, it's
a little Canadian.
Yeah, a little, frankly, a bit Canadian, as is Keanu Reeves, I recently discovered. Either in a pro Neal or an anti Neal moment, and you're never like in one or the other. And since the Tarantino movie is coming out here, which reminds us that the Laurel Canyon hippie singer songwriters consorted heavily with Charles Manson, I'm going to be in an anti Neal Young mode.
Although that trailer has a clip from, isn't it, Love 7 and 7 Is in it, is the song, and it's like awesome. The trailer for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
There's a new movie out coming. I think it's a Netflix original doc. Maybe it's already out called, Echo in the Canyon. That's about the Laurel Canyon music scene. And it looks pretty awesome. What?
Guys, Catherine just about passed out in the sound booth here, and then
so
broke up laughing.
It's so boring.
I know, screw yourself. I'm a pluralist. You know? You guys do you. I don't want to cramp your style. Also, the other good Neil is Neil Gaiman. Thank you.
Have not listened to Zuma are doomed to repeat it, Catherine.
Thank you. Neil Simon. Who was up for something or other last night and didn't get it, or maybe he didn't. Anyways, that's enough kneeling for one podcast.
We never kneel here at the Reason Podcast.
Hashtag never kneel.
Unless it's Neil Stephenson, in which case, yes.
Stevenson.
Stevenson.
See you next week. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Kneel before Zod.